the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Chris, do you mind revisiting a conversation we had real quick?
Not at all.
Rich Pounder and I were wondering, if you're eating an apple in the woods, you like stop for a moment and you eat an apple. You finish your apple. Why do you throw it? Why do you throw the core instead of just dropping it? Why do you want it? Like, you're not going to be there.
My theory was because, well, I think about it, like, I can't do that in my house.
You have to take it over to the trash can.
You have to take it to the trash, and you got to open it and delicately place it in. But when you're outside, you can just huck it.
Yeah.
And it feels good.
But if you were standing where, like, let's say you're eating an apple, and you finish it, and you huck it,
mm-hmm.
and where it lands. If you had eaten the apple where it landed, you'd huck it somewhere else.
Yeah. You just huck it away from wherever you're at the time.
I'm going to stop doing it, though. I'm going to start when I finish the apple. I'm setting that.
But you tried it, and you didn't like it, the trash being near you.
Yeah, I tried just dropping the apple core, since I'm not staying there anyway.
Yeah.
Just drop the apple core. But no, something about your body wants to huck.
I want to make a throwing motion right now, and I am not even eating an apple.
People like throwing shit.
They do.
Certain kinds of things.
Yeah.
I think it's the core is visually unpleasant. You don't want that sitting next to you. I think that's why we throw.
Really?
It might attract insects, animals.
No, that's not why you throw a core.
Well, I mean, you're saying you don't know exactly why, but it might be like...
In your deep down.
Yeah.
Well, in your deep down, you're...
Is that a part of you, your deep down?
Yeah, you're sure.
If I told you I was going to grab your deep down...
Don't they call it like the mammalian brain?
Yeah, like how little kids come pre-wired to fear snakes.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And we're pre-wired to distribute apple seeds.
Yeah.
Just like a bird. A bear.
Interesting.
I'm comfortable moving on. Is everybody good?
Hawking
course?
Yeah. We're good.
You know, what's funny, I'll point out, what got us talking about apple core, Hawking, was not an apple core. It's a damn banana peel.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to slip.
No.
You just don't want that thing around you. You want a like, clean little space.
Has anyone that you know ever slipped on a banana peel? Do we know anyone here who's actually done that?
You know, I feel like maybe we had a good laugh about someone once slipping on a banana peel. The writer Chris Offit once said to me, he didn't make this up, but talked about someone having one foot out the door and one on a banana peel or something like that. But no, I haven't. Maybe I...
Like, where did that start? Is that like a cartoon visualization that is now seeped into like all of our...
It's the kind of thing that you know from its representation rather than its individual reality.
Yeah.
Great story we heard the other night, and I think we can all put it together. Right. And then we're going to get into a couple listener issues before we get on to talking about what we're here to talk about. So a mug we were having dinner with the other night, his name's Hunter, and he kind of defies my old thing that if you have a kid and you want him to hunt, you're like, well, I'll name him Hunter, and then he'll become a hunter. And I've seen that backfire a lot, but not on this dude. What was this dude's name, Yanni?
Hunter Meekum. I think it's Meekum or Meacham.
He guides for Jay Scott and Dark Holborn. And he's a lion man. Mm-hmm. He's a houndsman.
Comes from a long line of houndsmen.
Comes from a long line of famous houndsmen who have a long line of famous hounds.
In Utah, I believe.
Yep. They hunt Utah. And his father and his uncle, or his family, does a lot of also helps out with a lot of research projects involving lions. He's telling a story about his uncle goes up, climbs up in a tree to tranquilize a mountain lion with a trank gun and takes a poke with the gun and misses. So I don't know if you can say, blouch! When it's a tranquilizer, but He shoots and misses the lion. So rather than, now he's got to reload the tranquilizer gun. So he lowers the tranquilizer gun down on a rope to some kind of college kid who's helping out on this project. And the college kid, he made a big point to point out that it was a college kid, reloads the tranquilizer gun and ties it through the trigger.
Mm.
The trigger guard, ties it through the trigger guard. So that once he starts hoisting the tranquilizer gun back up.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Blouch! Hits him with the tranquilizer dart.
Oh, man.
And he's out. His dad, this hunter's dad, packed his brother down off the on a mule. Tied to a mule, packed him down. He was out for 16 hours.
Whoa.
And they had to keep him up and keep his tongue, like, keep him positioned so his tongue wouldn't fall back in his head.
Which is exactly what they do with the lion.
Yeah. So they knew what to do. Could have very easily killed him.
Wow.
Tranked. Yeah, that'd be a good name for that movie.
Tranked.
Wow.
This has happened recently. Game warden from Oklahoma gets to chit-chatting on a Bumble. How many guys use Bumble or have used Bumble?
I have.
So like Ridge Pounders use,
yeah,
Bumble.
Yep.
Yeah.
Ocal.
Yep.
You've used Bumble.
Yep.
Kenyon, you got no business on there.
No.
Is that a hunting app?
Yep.
Sure is.
Yanni's got no business on there. And Rick.
Yep.
You've used Bumble. A dating app. So a game warden is chatting up a woman on Bumble, like fixing to date her. And she mentions that she's doing good because she just shot a huge buck. And he gets to asking her some questions about it and gets suspicious and doesn't do it as a date, but goes over there to do a little investigation. And sure enough, she'd poached a buck. Busted her while trying to romance her on Bumble.
That's amazing.
There's life.
In Oklahoma.
What's the moral of that story?
Don't poach.
Don't date. See, I took it to be don't date. Rick, before the show, I was asking you real quick. You got to decide right now, man. Do you want like a plug?
I really hope you do.
You do.
No. But I appreciate that you are looking out for me.
Yeah. Our friend Rick here, grade A photographer. Drone pilot, we just found out also. Grade A photographer and drone pilot.
No, that you don't want to mention that. These are not positives in the
in the dating world.
In the dating world.
No, women, if you're like he's like a nature documentary photographer. Mm-hmm.
But
that would be appealing to women.
Here's the issue though. If you're into essential oils, do not call Rick.
Yeah.
If you like multivitamins, do not call
it. That's also not a good thing to say.
Yeah, because here's a weird deal. If one was going to date Rick, is like you could picture that Rick might lure in. He might lure in people who had habits that Rick is against.
Because he wants to fix them.
No. Well, like he's very suspicious of vitamins. He's very suspicious of essential oils.
Skeptic overall.
He's a skeptic. But you could also see that ladies would be drawn to Rick who might have a crystal and some essential oils.
I'm not against that. I mean, I'm really not.
So those people can contact you as well.
Yeah. I don't judge.
You won't write anything off, man.
You're not in the market. You're not in the market. You're not out of the market.
I'm definitely not out of the
market. You're out in front of the market.
I'm in the market.
He's lurking outside of the market.
Like it's the co-op.
Lurk's
action.
Not a good
He's
word.
Lurking
though.
Outside the
yeah,
co-op.
Yeah, no lurking.
Lurk's not good.
Yeah.
That's not a good word.
When you're trying to
word
get
choice,
when you're
Steve,
trying to
choice.
Get women to find a guy who don't use lurking, that's right. That's he's hovering. No,
I don't know.
He's pathetically no.
I thought this was a hunting podcast, Steve.
Oh, we're getting to that.
This
Rick.
Is hunting.
We're getting
Speaking
to that.
Of lurking. I hope you're going to mention the little buck from your house.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good story.
That's a good story.
Can you keep that in mind?
I sure can.
Because I'm working down through my notes here. Got a couple things about bucks.
Did you finish pitching Rick?
Oh, Rick. He's too bashful. How do they find you? So we have a lot of female listeners. They want to find you. You know, they're like dying to date you.
Instagram. I feel like that's the way people find each other these days.
Is it Rick Smith Media?
Yeah, Rick Smith Media.
Slip in. No, not slip in. How do they say it? Slide in on Rick's DMs.
Oh, Giannis. Oh, huh? You're pretty much you're a millennial.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, Yannick?
The velvety tongue. No.
He's right on the edge. Right? How old are you?
I don't have no idea. 1978.
Yeah,
that's
not millennial.
That's pre-millennial.
Mm-hmm.
Got an email that contained the saddest line of all sad lines, and I've been thinking about this for a couple days now. A woman wrote in a letter, and her letter contained the line, "I'm a woman, and I'm gay, and so it's hard for me to find people to hunt with," which I feel like going hunting with her now. Saddest thing I've ever heard. Not an email.
So is she saying like one compounds the other, which
she's laying, she's like, I'm a woman. I'm just telling
super
you,
super hard.
I'm a woman and I'm gay. And so
which
it's
makes
hard,
it doubly hard
for me to find people to hunt with.
Huh.
That is a bummer.
Guy wrote in, we're talking about Santa Claus being a grade A hole because, you know, moving around captive servants all over the place. Spreading disease. Guy wrote in about that. That's not my idea, but he says, man, there should be a lot more scrutiny on Santa because he's going to, like, imagine the disease vector that guy's got going on with his captive deer going to every house, every Christian household in the world with his herd of deer, spreading Lord knows what around. And this guy says, if you're really going to hack on Santa, think about it like this. He says, it's my understanding that deer can't see red. So the only way, if all the other deer were so mean to Rudolph, the only way they would have known is if Santa told them that his nose was different.
I think his nose is bigger.
So
though.
Santa's like bullying.
That's kind of funny.
Santa's like, you guys can't see it because you can't see red. You can't see that wavelength to check it out. I can see it, and that reindeer is way different, and y'all should be mean to him. It's a very good point.
It's an interesting observation.
Another thing on deer real quick. Ryan, QDMA?
Fear.
Fear. He has something interesting to say. Talking about antler restrictions. So he says, prior to 2002, do you know this, Kenyon?
I couldn't tell you the numbers are at the top of my head, but I'm aware of the general trend you're going to tell me about.
Do you mind explaining what an antler restriction is?
An antler point restriction would be a regulation put in place by a state requiring a certain number of antler points on a deer's antler for you to be able to legally shoot it. So in Pennsylvania, I think in most parts of the state, they put an APR for short. They put an APR in place of 4 points on a side for a buck to be legal.
Oh, man. That's a steep antler restriction. He's got to be a Michigan 8.
Yeah, and I'm not from Pennsylvania, so there might have been a part of the state that was a 3 point on one side, part of the state was 4 point on one side. That might be the case. But I believe Seth is
too sick to even have a headphone on, but
most states 3 on one side, some of the states 4 on the one side. Okay. Yeah. So I've got an uncle who hunts in the 4 on a side part, which is why I know the story. But it was with a stated goal of trying to help more 1.5-year-old bucks make it to an older age class.
Yeah, he wrote in because we were having this conversation where I was saying, I don't have any data to support this, but I was saying, man, like, all the damn bucks when I was a kid were 1.5 old. I mean, virtually all of them.
You mean all the bucks taken?
Yeah, it's like everybody, you shot bucks and they were all the same. Spikes, yeah. Forks, little sixers, right? Just little, like, not, you know, they're 1.5 old bucks. It was a real rarity. Like, I remember when the old man shot a buck that was not, it was like a giant, you know, in our mind. And but he was saying he didn't have any statistics off the at his fingertips for Michigan. But he's saying prior to 2002, when Pennsylvania introduced mandatory antler restrictions, there 90% of the bucks harvested were 1.5 years old. So for you folks that aren't quick at math, 9 out of 10 bucks were only 1.5 old. Of that 90%, 80% of those were killed on opening day of gun season. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I'm going to let that sink in for a minute. Then he goes on to say this. He says, in a nutshell, the biggest part of our annual buck harvest, you know, we killed all of our bucks basically in 2 days of the season. 90% of those were 1.5 years old. At the time, there were about 1.2 million licensed hunters in Pennsylvania. That trend, he says, was the norm in those days. In 2015 was the first time in our nation's hunting history. So we're outside of Pennsylvania now. 2015 was the first time in our nation's hunting history that we saw that trend change. As a nation of hunters, we harvested more 3.5-year-olds than 1.5-year-olds in 2015. Does that surprise you, Mark Kenyon? Wired to hunt?
It doesn't. I've been following that trend for probably a decade now, and it's been moving that direction more and more. And I just got the data here from this year, looking back at the most recent data. So that would have been from the 2017-18 season would be the most recent data. And that shows that still we're at the lowest, record lowest harvest levels for year-and-a-half-olds nationally still. So in Pennsylvania, you mentioned 90%, 9 out of 10 bucks killed a year-and-a-half-old. Now nationally, only 35% of bucks harvested are year-and-a-half-old.
Really?
Nationwide. Yeah. So pretty interesting. And 34% were 3 year older, 3.5 or older.
Somebody tell me what's going on.
I'll tell you what's going on, Rick. People used to shoot a lot of dinkers. Now they're shooting biggins.
Yeah, but the why?
Oh.
I understand the... I didn't need a recap. I needed some analysis.
I needed the recap.
So, Rich, you up to speed now?
I'm up to speed. I'm really happy that happened. Yeah. I don't know about move on. Rick's got a good question, but...
Mark, tell him what happened.
Well... Yeah, there's a little bit of a like a egg and the chicken kind of thing here, but probably the biggest thing going on here is there's been change in culture around whitetail deer hunting, in that a lot of hunters started to see and learn and hear about the benefits of letting young deer reach older age classes. And a lot of that is to the credit of Ryan's employer, the Quality Deer Management Association, who's done a pretty cool job of talking about a lot of different things that we can do as deer hunters and managers to try to, you know, manage for a more natural, balanced deer herd. Of course, though, to Steve's point that he makes sometimes, which is true, hunters, we get a kick out of big deer too. So a lot of people realize that, hey, if I can make decisions that help the deer herd and help me see and maybe kill some bigger bucks, that's like a fun, beneficial thing to do. So a lot more people saw those benefits and started passing on younger deer. And they started doing things to improve the habitat that might help deer get bigger, and a slew of other things over the years that the last 10, 15 years have really changed the landscape when it comes to deer across America. So, yeah, there's a lot more older deer and a lot more deer that are bigger, too.
Dude wrote in. You good? Rick, you cool?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Was that satisfied?
Yeah, I could ask some questions.
Please.
Well, I mean, I just don't know, have any idea, but as the deer get older, does that change the, like, what is that, how is that affecting the population area or herds? How does it benefit?
Can we put that off?
Yeah.
To a future episode?
Yeah, yeah, no. Yeah,
well, we're going to focus on that in a future episode.
Okay, cool.
Yep. Is that okay with you, Giannis?
I'll tell you when it comes out.
All right.
Listen to it.
Yeah, no, that's the only way I learn about hunting is by listening to the podcast, so.
Everyone good? Yanni, you good so far?
Ready to roll? I am.
Guy says he's got a real beef with me. He says that I got coyote cooking all wrong. He says he's saying that he saw me cook a coyote where we roasted it with the skin on. And he said that's a sure way to ruin any game animal. That would make even squirrel taste awful. This is him talking. Then he goes on to say, I very much enjoy coyote meat and prefer to chunk it up and fry it dusted in flour. It tastes like a mild combination of lamb and pork and is a great way to add variety to the dinner table. I would love to see you guys give it another try with the care the meat deserves. That's good. That's fine. But I have, contrary to this man's opinion, I have had a wonderful squirrel cooked where you burn the hair off of the squirrel and then roast the squirrel with its skin on. In Vietnam, I had a wonderful, kind of a weird squirrel possum looking marsupial critter that a guy had shot out of a tree with an air rifle, that he burned all the hair off and then roasted with its skin. If you read about the Plains tribes, they would cook domestic dog that way by burning all the hair off and roasting it in the skin. I've had wild pork, wild pig, by burning all the hair off and roasting it in the skin, and that was delectable. As for coyote being good, how many of you guys have had coyote? Cal?
Nope. I haven't.
Nope.
Jan, you've had a little nibble.
A little nibble.
One
we
last
should,
one.
We should go kill some, though, because I want to try Bendrix's recipe, too.
You think we should give it a try?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't touched one since I ate my last one. A guy wrote in, he had hunted in Bolivia. He was down hunting with some indigenous people in Bolivia, and he was marveling how they, two things. They went out to hunt tapir, and they had a 16-gauge shell, and they cut it open and put some kind of own their own little, they cut it open and took the shot out and made their own little slug somehow and put it in there and used it to kill a tapir. And he said that they quartered it with the skin on, salted it like crazy. But it reminded me of thinking about, like, this talking about shotguns reminded me of a thing. I was with some guys in South America that had a 16-gauge shotgun, but their only ammo was 12-gauge shotgun shells. So they were going out night hunting, and they would take their, cut open their 12-gauge shell and cut open their 16. No, let me back up. Yeah. They had a 16-gauge shotgun and a bunch of spent shells.
Yeah.
And they had a box of good 12-gauge shells. So they laid out some leaves, like bowl-shaped leaves, cut the 12-gauge shell open, dumped the shot into a leaf, pulled the wad out, poured the powder out, knocked the primer out of the 12-gauge shell, put the primer into the 16-gauge shell, poured the powder in there, took toilet paper and made a wadding, and packed the wad down, poured the shot in, got a candle out, and wax sealed the thing shut. And they'd get two or three of those made up, and then it was time to go hunting.
Wow.
Yeah. And one night they go out and they come back with a couple birds, and they had an aquatic rodent that they'd killed, and they didn't have enough. And so they went through this whole process and made one more shell and then went back out in their boat. And a while later came back and they were done hunting.
Wow.
It's good stuff.
That is good stuff.
Okay.
We got it good, don't we?
Where to begin? Tamales.
Oh. Me gusta.
we're just finishing up a hunt in Sonora, Mexico. Not far from, you know, a ways off, not far from the U.S. border. You can see land features across the line in the U.S. And it's kind of an auspicious time to be down here hunting because, you know, we're engaged in a great national debate about the ramifications and costs and merits of constructing a border wall. So it's been funny to be down flirting with the border and seeing the border and being down here hunting. It's been like more, I've come down here a number of times over the years to hunt, and it's been more sort of, I don't know, the geopolitics around my mind now more than normal being down in Mexico. Coos deer.
But it felt just the same as years past.
The hunting, the land.
Well, and the whole travel and the process.
Oh,
across the border.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I didn't mean to suggest that it was problematic in any way.
You weren't. I was just adding that.
Yeah. Not that it was problematic anyway, but just like an interesting time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
To come down and hunt. And coos deer, it's coos deer, also pronounced cow's deer. A kind of a weird dude with a real weird personal history. Elliot Coos is the guy whose name was applied to these deer, and you'll hear him called Desert Whitetails. A little dinky 90-100-pound whitetails that live in the mountainous desert, in the Sky Island Mountain chains. Some in New Mexico, a great many in Arizona, and then this is kind of like the good old days down here in Mexico. There's got to be more coos deer down here than in all of Arizona, wouldn't you guess?
Yeah. In all of Sonora?
Lots of coos deer.
Lots of coos deer.
So, came down, and I've never hunted down here any way but this way. Mm-hmm. Like, we've never come down not with working with... Talk about Jay, how you used to work for him.
My buddy Jay. Yeah, I used to work for him as a fishing guide. He was a client of mine. That's how we met.
Yeah, I didn't realize that you guys met that way.
Floating down the old Eagle River. Mm-hmm.
So you guided him fishing, and then you started guiding for him.
Yeah, that's right. In Arizona, a little bit down here.
In those big famous elk units in Arizona.
That's right. Good times.
Anything you'd like to add about that? You're being awful curt.
I had a lot of fun hanging out. When I see Dar down here, I always think back on those times and miss him, because Dar and I used to guide together and have a lot of good laughs. So, yeah. No, I don't know what to add about it. It was good. But yeah, so Jay, had no idea how time flies, but Jay said this is his 21st year of doing this down here.
Really?
Yeah.
Jay Scott has glassed up. The last time I asked him this question, how many mountain lions he's ever glassed up, the last time I talked to him, he was at 32. It's like he spends so much time glassing, you know, looking through his binos or spotting scopes. His number now, he's glassed up 43. So if you think you spend a lot of time out hunting, add up how many mountain lions you've seen through your binos. And then consider that this man has glassed up 43 mountain lions while looking for other junk.
Yeah, if you're a Western hunter, spend a lot of time behind the glass. This really wouldn't work for a dude that sits in tree stands for whitetail.
No, you could wait a long time for a mountain lion to walk by.
Yeah.
But what Jay does, so Jay guides in Mexico. He guides elsewhere too, but he guides in Mexico, and he guides for Gould's turkeys and guides for coos deer, but also does, give him the spiel, Yanni. You'll do a better job of it.
He basically does like a DIY program for guys that want to come down to Mexico and hunt coos deer. And so the hunt itself is completely DIY, but he arranges the ranch and then helps with your paperwork for crossing your firearms across the border, and then kind of gives you just kind of lays out the whole process of what it's going to take to cross the border going both directions. But he'll basically secure a ranch and secure deer tags for that ranch, and then you buy those through Jay, you know, but the ranch provides them. And then he basically helps you get your firearm permit for Mexico, and then gives you like a real clean rundown of like, this is what you need. If you're going to bring a vehicle across the border, you need the insurance and a letter that says that you're the owner, has had the VIN number, this, that, and the other, and then gives you real clear directions. And he also offers, I think, like what we call fixers or like and translators, like they can be at the border to meet you, to help you through that process, to get you to your ranch. Then once you're at the ranch, you're on your own.
And it's like having a chunk of national, it's not national forest because very much privately owned land, but it's like, it's like you, when you cross the border and come down in here, not that far, man, it's like you've gone back like 100 years back in time. Huge ranches. People mm-hmm. still work cattle on horseback.
It's great, man. I mean, I had a very different idea of how this trip was going to be when I got the offer to jump on. And yeah, this whole situation is really fantastic. And the folks that we've had helping us out here at the Rancho are great. And it's just kind of like, it's nice watching and being around folks who are living simply and, you know, kind of feel like a bum because they're working. But, you know, while we're tramping the hills, but it's just nice. It, it's kind of relaxing.
Oh yeah, man. Cutting loose, wandering around like a giant chunk of property.
That's yeah.
Got a bunch of deer hiding out in the mountains in it.
Yeah. And it's great too. Cause it's not like, you're not like walking down to some, or not even walking in some cases. You're not just like stepping out the door and looking at some center pivot that's fully irrigated and chuck, chuck, chucking away. And there's deer living in there night and day. And, you know,
I wouldn't mind having a spot or two like that.
Well, then you wouldn't see any of the ranch, you know? I mean, this has been awesome because, you definitely got to do some exploring and checking out new stuff. And it's been great. It's been great.
Man, it's funny back home hunting whitetails. When you talk about a property you can hunt, you know, if I said I got a big property to hunt, that'd be like 150 acres, 200 acres. I'd be really excited about that. When you're talking about this kind of scale we have out here, like you said, it does feel like national forest. It's vast. It seems unending almost.
Tens of thousands of acres.
Yeah.
Completely undeveloped.
You hike all day, never cross the border.
Yeah, completely like not developed. It's just a different. Yeah. It's just different, man.
Wild.
The way you hunt coosier is you get up. This isn't the way it has to happen, but typically, you get up on the kind of the biggest, highest peaks around that you can find, and you have to just watch the surrounding hillsides very, very, very carefully. They're extremely hard to pick up.
The brush is tall and the animal is small. And it, like for me, one thing that really struck me and something that I had to kind of like recalibrate my brain over and over again to was it, When any animal stands out in the wide open, you're kind of like, oh yeah, there he is. And they seem like bigger than life. But when they're in that brush, these things are so small that freehanding my binoculars at often, many times throughout this hunt, freehanding my binoculars would be frustrating to the point where I thought it was pointless. Like I had to have them on the tripod.
Yeah.
Because so many times I'd like looked at a deer and the only reason that I caught it was because of the motion of the deer. And that could be like the chin moving as it's chewing its cud, like little white flashes from its chin moving, or just an ear flicker, or, you know, maybe in a generous way, it'd be like a big white tail giving a flap. And so if your binoculars were moving at all, you know, at 1100 yards, you're going to miss that little bit of motion. It was just amazing. I had a hard time giving them the credit that they were due as far as their ability to disappear.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and then to compound on that, if you were to somehow, you know, well, even if you had them on a tripod, if you bumped them or in any way left that singular focus on that little bit of movement, you'd almost never find it again. So if you handheld, you're stuck.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because you're looking at like a sea of brushy slopes.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes you'll be sitting there with your buddies that you're hunting with, and you'll be like, oh, got one. And they'll be like, where? And you'll be like, I can't tell you. I don't know. I can't take my eyes yeah. off it to get yeah. the context. And you can't, you know that the minute you move your eye to figure out where it is that your binoculars are centered on it to, in order to explain it, that something's going to happen. You're going to lose track of the deer.
Yeah. It's like the world's best game of Where's Waldo.
Oh, it's fun. But it's like, it's, they just vanish.
Yeah.
Then you see them and oftentimes you like catch them and you never catch them again. Oh, buck. He went into the, never mind. And you never see him again. And we're hunting them during the rut. So you and Jan even watched two deer make love.
Yeah, did. That's the second time I've seen that happen this year.
I was commenting on the strong oral component.
Yes, there was a lot
of said lovemaking.
A lot of before and after.
Yeah.
That. Okay, that needs to be further defined.
Oh, really?
I don't want to define
we gotta
anymore.
Go further down that road.
I know you don't. It's a good
family. It's a family program. There's two things. And you know, I've heard guys like big whitetail guys talking to you, Mark, you're kind of the main one I know. talk about bucks being locked down.
Yeah.
A lockdown being that there's a period like in the breeding cycle when you can't find any big bucks because the big bucks are just standing there by a doe and not doing anything. They're just hanging out with the doe. And man, like we saw two kinds of buck activity. Bucks that were just moving so fast and so much that it was like you couldn't go get them if you wanted them because they just come in and out of your life. You know? Oh, there he is. You kind of work. You watch him. You lose him. You watch him. You lose him. You watch him. You lose him. And pretty soon he's way the hell down the hill and he's gone. And he's just gone. Or you catch a glimpse of him and he goes into some giant sea of brush and never comes back out and he's gone out of your life. But then the ones we got, no, that's not really true. Yeah.
Two.
So the best opportunities were bucks that were so intensely focused on a single doe that they would allow, we watched one today, that would go 20 minutes not moving his feet and not taking a bite to eat, but just stand there for 20 minutes and watch a doe feed 10, 20 yards away from him. And like all that's on his mind is standing there. They like to be a little higher. Standing, it seems like they like to be a little teeny bit higher than the doe and just stand there and stare at her.
It was very familiar whitetail behavior in that regard. That seemed like something, yeah, it makes sense. You saw some number of bucks cruising, which was that first behavior you talked about, just moving around, trying to find that doe. And then when a buck did have a doe, sometimes several bucks all trying to be close to that doe, but typically there's that one that is with a doe that's ready to breed. You have that lockdown phenomena. And yeah, I mean, we all, I think, saw situations like that.
Their patience is kind of amazing, or whatever it is, their focus. Especially when you get a look at the parasite load on these things.
Yeah.
They have dozens of per... I think if you looked at a patch of their hide, 3 inches by 3 inch, there's 20 or so ticks. You look around the bald spot, just around their anus, the hairless patch around there, crawling with ticks. They have nasal bots living in the back of their throat that can be the size of like the end of your pinky. Their forelegs are perforated with cactus thorns and all that, and they can stand there staring at a lady.
I think we've all been there.
I don't know, man.
That's a lot of stuff, man.
a lot of ticks, Mark.
Yeah.
Not necessarily ticks, but we've all been focused on the press.
With Mark, it was crabs. But,
you know, that buck's thinking the exact same thing we're thinking when we're looking through the spotting scope or the binoculars, though, right? Mm. He's like, man, if I take my eyes off of her, I may never see her again.
Yeah, he knows, right? He's going to lose her.
Yeah.
It's kind of become one of my favorite types of hunting, those, to hunt coos deer.
Man,
cows deer.
I loved every minute of it. Like, and I never had a moment where I was like, God, I hope I fill this tag. I was always like, well, this goes on another day. I'm all right with that.
What I think happened with the buck you got, that's the first time I've ever seen it happen with a coos deer, I think, is kind of like stumbling into a buck.
Yes, very much.
Went up to a glass and knob and then found a buck.
Yeah, and you know what's extremely unique about that for me is I can count on one hand the amount of times I've filled my tag before everybody else in camp has filled their tag. Like, I always, mostly by choice, am the last person to fill my tag.
Yeah.
It's kind of where I feel more comfortable, I think, mostly from growing up doing the guiding thing.
But Steve had purposely walked away without his gun.
Without his gun.
nor binoculars. And then we saw a buck.
But I wasn't considering myself to be up anyway.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, to me...
No, I was thinking, in my mind, you were up.
It helped my decision-making so, so much. Because you had your toiletry kit in your hand.
I was going over to find a rock that I was going to flip over. And then do something. Then flip that rock back over on top of it. And come back and check on y'all.
And I was just... It was like the perfect green light for me. Because I was like, all right, well, this isn't even an argument at this point. Because my inclination would have been like, Steve, get your gun.
No, I would have said no. No, 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 no.
I can just attest to what an amazingly stealthy crew you get to run around with. That's seven of us just waltzed right up to 200 yards. And they were able to film it all.
It's hard using the
is a good crew.
Hand signals all day and being nonverbal and all sneaky like that.
You spotted him too, didn't you? It's like as soon as we got up there, you were like, shh.
He was there. Oh, the eagle. Why do you think why do you think we call him the eagle?
Dude, you cannot mess with the eagle.
Why do you think he gets the work here?
Because he's the eagle.
It's not because of his sass. It's not. We don't keep him for his sass.
What about his shoulders?
Yes, the big beefy shoulders helps a lot. His lack of verbosity right now is not helping him. But the
what's
eagle,
verbosity?
How many words one uses? But the eagle is the eagle, man. Like a very, like if you said he gave me a very verbose explanation,
Got it.
It'd be like a lots there.
A loquacious one.
Oh, that's a good word, too.
Yeah. Jesse. Look at that. When he does strike, he strikes.
Yeah, man.
It's kind of a sassy word.
Now, with Mark's buck, we spotted up some bucks.
So that was a non-trad coos deer kill.
That was a non-trad coos deer kill. That was the first time I've seen that happen. It was the first time in the...
I killed my buck last year that way.
No.
Yeah.
Last year. Oh, you still hunted
with John and I, John Snow and I.
I forgot about last year. Yeah, but I wasn't there.
You weren't.
So the ones I've been in on, I've never seen it play out where, it's always played out where you see it far off and then have to do some things to get over and get a crack at it. The ones I've been in on, which is a good handful. Yeah, it was the first one I've seen where we actually kind of came upon one. Mark's was more classic coos deer situation.
Yep.
Spied him from about 1,000 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to work downhill and get, 700-800 yards closer.
Yeah. First time I ever done anything like that. Because I think, telling Yanni, I've never mule deer hunted, never coos deer hunted. I've only ever bow hunted 95% of the time for whitetails. Occasionally use a shotgun or muzzleloader to shoot like 100-yard shots max. So this is way outside of my ballpark of experience.
So that was awesome.
Yeah. And all the hunting this guy's done, that was the longest shot he's ever taken.
Oh yeah, and the longest shot before that was my shot last year on the caribou. So you guys have stretched, and prior to that, it was probably like 95 yards. So you guys have really stretched me when it comes to firearms, which is good. But yeah, we spotted that buck at 1,000 yards or so and decided that we thought he was a shooter. And Yanni and myself and Seth went tearing down the hill and went down the steep canyon at about 300 yards, came up to this little rise at the bottom of this valley. There's a small kind of knoll. And we got to the top of that rise.
Called the shooting knob.
Shooting knob. And couldn't see.
Can I interject real quick? Because I want to point out an important part of coos deer hunting.
Yeah.
When you're watching a coos deer and you're thinking like you're going to go after it, that's great. You found a buck, you're going to go after it. But the tricky question is, where exactly are you going to go? Because it doesn't really work generally. It doesn't work to get on his slope. You got to find a little perch or something where you can shoot over into his area. Like some kind of terrain feature where you might plausibly like get there and look into his brushy little zone. You can't get on his not that you can't, but typically it would not work to get on his slope.
In this spot set up perfectly in that way.
Because you had a little perch.
Yeah, had a shooting
knob. Is that what I call it? A shooting knob.
Shooting knob. Yeah. And the other thing that's important to point out, I think, that it was a thing I learned from this trip, was the importance of, before making that stalk, you really need some reference points locked in as far as where you saw that deer last.
Yeah.
Because
you're going to lose it.
Your changed perspective really flips things around. So I remember seeing that there's a really thick patch of junipers, especially thick on this hillside. And so I remember seeing the buck and the doe in that on the right side of that thick patch last. But then it was actually Seth who had made the very most important reference point, was the fact that we had last seen the buck and doe next to a tree with a very unique white circle on it. So when we ended up getting back to that shooting knob, we found the thick patch of junipers, and then we could narrow down our point of focus even further by looking for that tree with the white circle on it. So we really could zero in on where they were last. And they were very locked down, like we were talking about earlier. They hadn't moved very much at all.
And we had come up with a very rudimentary signaling system using Yanni's Blaze Orange How to Gut a Deer bandana.
Yeah.
Available at themeateater.com. Currently out of stock, I believe, but coming back in stock soon. A little signaling system where, if need be, like we agreed that if I didn't do anything, that meant nothing had changed.
And if I can interject, I kind of wished that there was another signal that we had, which meant, what am I trying to say here? We were getting that from you many times when we looked at you. But we were not sure if you were just doing that because you didn't see us.
Or if I got bored.
Or if you were doing it because the deer was still doing what it was supposed to be doing.
Oh, I got you.
So we needed some kind of confirmation that you actually saw us and realized that we were asking for the update.
There's no update.
Yeah.
Buck hadn't moved.
But we needed confirmation.
Yeah. So I'm perched up watching the buck from afar. And you're coming in, and our agreement was, if I don't do anything, there's nothing you need to know from me. If not, I was going to take a orange bandana and tie it to a pole and point from my perspective what direction the deer went on the face of the slope, but never needed to do it.
Yep. So, you know, I looked back at you a handful of times. You weren't doing anything, so the assumption was the deer was still in there. Yep.
Just a dead stare on my face.
Yeah. That's what it was. And came up to the top of that first knob, creeped up. Really, we crawled to the top of that knob, and it was about 300 yards, I think, at that point, and just could not see anything. Just we stayed there a good, decent bit. I don't know, 20 minutes?
Yeah, at least. Maybe even 30.
Maybe more. Glassing, but no movement. So finally, we could see that there was still more of that ridge that was hidden by the furthest edge of our glassing knob. There was a slight rise, and we just couldn't see beneath that. And so we assumed then if this buck's still in there, it's got to be beneath the rise. So we had to make a final like 70-yard creep, and finally decided to do that. We crept in, got right to the kind of highest point of that little rise, got down on hands and knees, and that's when I spotted the doe. stops, glass, see the doe. Kind of made a game plan for what we were going to do next. Knew that there must be the buck somewhere nearby. And then I spotted the buck. Not too far away in the brush. It was like just, you know, thick junipers and whatever other junk's down there.
Oak.
Oak. And I remember in this, the first fleeting glance of him, I remember thinking, ah, it doesn't quite look like the buck we saw originally. And I turned to you, Yanni, and said, I don't know if it's the same buck. Mm-hmm. It looks like he has shorter tines. But then he moved off and crawled further and kind of got in position to where I could get a shot in that general area. So we got positioned, looking for them again. And then I'm like, hey, got the buck again. I could see this buck standing underneath that exact tree we had referenced earlier, the strange white circle tree. He was right there underneath that tree again, in the shade, in the tangle. And I just remember saying, hey, there's the buck. And I range him 230 yards. So within range. And I'm looking at him, and he's dark antlered, and he's seemed wide-ish. I just could not see tine length. And I'm thinking to myself, God, I think this buck had longer tines that we saw earlier. I don't know. This buck's in range. I can't remember if we looked back. I think Seth was trying to get a camera on it, and we asked him, like, can you see him? Is he look? Is it that buck? And he's like, I'd shoot it if it was me. And everything was kind of lined up, you know. It worked out well for the crew. Yanni and Seth were there, and it was my first coos deer buck, and it looked pretty sweet. So got settled on him, and like you mentioned earlier, that was my longest shot ever on an animal. So took my time getting really settled in nicely, and had a bipod and the rifle set in my backpack, and put a pad underneath my right elbow, and just slowed it down as best I could. Took the shot.
Well, it's funny, is I was watching the other buck through a spot and scope on a pretty narrow
focus. We haven't yet pointed out the fact that this was not the original buck.
Doesn't matter. But it's just funny that I was... okay. So go on.
Well, yeah. So the point being that the buck I ended up shooting was not the original one we spotted.
Was not the one I was watching to see what it would do. But I'm staring at it through a spotting scope, the one that we had always been looking at. And I hear a shot, and all of a sudden a buck runs into my field of view and through my spotting scope, and within a second falls over dead right in front of the buck I've been watching for all that time. And that buck seemed to not care about that at all, but eventually got like, yeah, he kind of had an attitude like, yeah, better him than me. And then he went up and over top of the ridge and out of our lives.
I don't know how we never saw that other buck.
Just
because you said he was so close, right?
Can't see anything, man. It's too confusing.
We talk about when he grunted right beneath us?
We're not there yet.
Not there yet.
Yeah.
Then all kinds of weird stuff happened.
But we couldn't see him just because he was like the same reason we couldn't see the other deer before we moved. I think he was just below.
Just below us, so probably.
The plane that we could see. Yeah, I feel bad too, man, because I so badly wanted to help out and like look and stuff, but I was running a camera, and I'm always so torn. I'd always rather just throw that camera in the ditch and this glass and be like, there he is, don't shoot, shoot, whatever. But, man, I got to sit there and try to get my coverage.
It's tough, man. No, man. You did good work. Did good work.
Well, we don't know yet. We'll see.
I guess that's true.
Mark's hunt might not even be included in the episode. We'll see.
Is this the first hunt you filmed?
No.
Okay. How long has it been since you filmed one?
Not that long. I filmed a little bit this fall.
Where'd you
seek a deer hunt?
Yeah.
With Mark, actually. Was that with you?
No.
Cal was on the hunt.
That was you and I.
Oh, yeah.
In that tripod stand in the middle of the
swamp. I was filming Cal on that hunt.
Yeah.
And then I do a little bit here and there.
You did, and I think you did another one. You pick up a camera pretty often.
Yeah.
But I feel you on the, like, not being able to look and see what's going on. I mean, and I often want to see what's happening, but I'm just stuck in the lens of my camera. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't see where the animal is. I don't get to pull out my binoculars. So it's all, like, almost imaginary. Everybody's real excited about something. I'm not looking at it. I'm, like, looking in the opposite direction.
Dude, but this trip, I was, like, normally I'm like super, super excited to shoot. And I was to film. Yeah, good clarification. But like, normally we'll film as every like hunter's getting in and getting settled and pulling out their binoculars, and I just wanted that part to get done so then I could sit down, pull out my binoculars, and start looking around.
You spotted up a couple deer.
I did. Yeah,
you're getting a lot better.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, more on this trip than normal.
You still had mama's milk on your lip when we picked you up, man.
Dude, the first
thing, we were talking about that today.
Oh yeah,
first hunt.
Nice old game spotter.
Yeah.
Yeah. The buck I got was kind of like real standard sort of coos deer situation.
There was, I think there's a good example in there though, because I was thinking about it. Because the terrain, your buck was locked down when we took off, but we did a lot of walking and sneaking and trying to get around for quite a while.
Yeah, you go way the hell out of your way to try to eventually wind up in a spot where you're in his zone without him knowing you got into his zone.
Yeah, and really didn't shave off. You know, I think I ranged him when we made the decision to go, and it was like 584 yards. And then 20 minutes of hiking around and sneaking, we were at 544 yards. Like, we did a lot of moving around to try to get to a spot where we could close distance. And then, we weren't effectively narrowing down that yardage. And then once we got in there, it was a great stock, great hunt, because there's always that apprehension of like, oh man, this cannot work out. This cannot work out, because the angle, in order to close that yardage down to a comfortable shooting situation, it made the angle to the buck very difficult. Made it a very difficult killing situation, even though it was within effective range.
And this is kind of for a lack of a shooting knob, right?
Not a good shooting knob. Bet you found a shooting knob though. But we had to poke and pry to find a knob that would let you look up into his little spot there.
There's a lot going on up there too.
Yeah. At one point, you guys had coos deer, javeline, and a coyote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me and Seth, we stuck back and glassed from the original distance. And yeah, that buck that you ended up shooting was locked on with a doe. Four other bucks were kind of circling, trying to move in on that doe. And it was pretty cool is that your buck would run one of those bucks off, run off 30, 40 yards, and then storm right back to the doe, make sure she was still there. Then he'd run off with a buck, run right back. And then, yeah, the javelinas came passing right through, maybe 20 yards beneath him at one point. Right around the same time, the coyote trolled through, and that buck stayed right next to the doe. You could see all the deer, just their eyes following that coyote, the whole path he took. And then he left, and then it was right back to the doe. So it's kind of a fun little wildlife watching situation I had there while you were stalking in.
It's amazing that, at least I won't see that footage until, who knows, long time from now.
Yeah. And then you'll be like, oh, that's right. That was cool.
Couple months.
No, I always like, it's fun to have that stuff. People be like, hey, did you take in any photos from your trip? Like, I took a TV show on my trip.
Must be nice.
That was a very fun hunt, though. That was a good one.
Who wants to be in charge of talking about how you make tamales?
Hold on, aren't you going to tell everybody how you got to shoot my buck for me too?
Oh, you can go ahead and tell that story. Yeah, you're just not like saying anything. You call. Go ahead.
It's hard to say things.
Well, it's getting. It's tired. Everybody's tired. I'm looking a lot of yawning just, faces.
I really just like that
voices.
Line.
A lot of other folks talking. But no, after Steve shot his buck, Steve and Chris walked up the hill to go retrieve it, find it, recover it. And Cal and I were waiting down there. And I forget, did you just look up and go, oh, there's another buck standing up there?
It was it was just locked in place.
No, I know, but did you see it?
Is that how we found out about it? There was the small buck chasing the doe.
Oh yeah, we saw that. Right, $2 chasing that doe.
And then another buck like bombed in, and they eventually chased the doe and right through where your buck expired, Steve's buck expired, and I was kind of like, oh my god, hopefully one of these deer isn't Steve's buck that just magically got up and ran away. But yeah, then that buck was down there in the peripheral view.
He just showed up. I don't know. Well, Mark had spotted him earlier, the same buck. Anyways, he's standing there looking down at us, and in our from our point of view, it looks like he's 30 yards to the left of Chris and Steve. And you guys are up there making television, so Steve's not talking in a quiet voice.
Mm-mm.
He's doing his thing, recovering the animal. And finally, you guys get done doing what you're doing, and Steve is yelling down on us like, hey, come on up here.
No.
You weren't? What were you yelling at us about?
I didn't yell at you.
We did. We got a whoop or something like that.
Yeah. You got our attention.
No.
Okay. Well, a voice from up Ridge the hill. Pounder,
did I have occasion to go whoop?
Not typically. Not since I've known you. I do remember Cal shouting up. You guys might have heard us talk because when you're... Like when we were up there, we were projecting pretty loud,
going whoop.
Probably not whoop. I don't remember a whoop, but that might have been me actually. The hey yeah might have been me.
Well, tell me
more
what
of
happened.
A yeehaw.
All of a sudden, you guys were hooting and hollering.
You guys recovered the deer.
We recovered the deer.
You made a little television.
We made a little scene. We filmed some stuff.
Yeah, we found the dead deer.
And then I remember hearing Cal being like, "Hey, can you guys take a couple steps to your left or whatever, to the north or whatever."
No, he definitely said go north. I went south.
Oh, yeah, go north. And we went the wrong way.
And he
like,
said
go
the other north.
Way.
I specified 100 yards.
No, 100 yards, yeah. We just started yelling because you guys didn't have a radio.
Yeah.
We just started yelling. We have a buck at 200-some yards. You guys are 200 yards.
And 30, we had hiked
30
up
yards
there.
From the buck.
Yeah.
And we're going, hey, can you move a couple hundred yards to our right? And you yell back, why? And we're like, well, there's a deer up there. Yanni's going to shoot him if you guys can walk like way the hell off of that slope. So
and that's what we did.
You guys did. And the bucks stood there through the whole thing.
Like,
that's
insane, man.
And Yanni and
so
I's conversation is like, well, boy, it's a nice buck. It's right there. This would be, you know, we only have so much time to, you know, fill the tag. And it's like, well, if I just yell at those guys and he stays there, kind of got to take him, right?
Yeah, we figured it'd be worth a try.
Right.
We figured as soon as we started yelling, you know, the buck would just scatter.
Skedaddle.
Leave the hill. But
it's hard to imagine what was going on with him.
Yeah.
I think that doe was just, he knew he was the second biggest buck on the slope. It was batter up time for him because the first biggest buck was out of the equation. And those two smaller bucks were now chasing that doe. But you and Pounder were in between him and that doe. And he was like really, he found himself in a very contemplative situation.
He did not move a muscle.
No.
You know, it's really interesting, though. I've never seen this before, obviously, since I've never been in a situation like this where you're watching someone shooting an animal from a decent bit away. But I was glassing this whole thing, watching it through my binos. And both with your buck, Steve, and Giannis, I saw the deer react to the bullet before I heard the gunshot go off.
Yeah. Mm.
That was pretty interesting.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
That was cool. I was like, oh, what's he doing? And then boom.
Yes.
That was neat.
Yeah.
So yeah, deer just fell over.
Well, neither of them fell over.
Yeah, my shot wasn't quite on the mark. I missed them just a hair right. I couldn't tell
like
what went on in there, man, because one shoulder was completely just annihilated to the point where I didn't even bother trying to trim me. Well, we took the shank. That's how much was good of it. It was still, you know, edible. And there was a hole going into the body cavity on the inside of that shoulder. But anyways, the thing wasn't quite ready to die, so Steve walked over to it and had to sort of run it down, shoot
chase him downhill.
Yeah, finally got one in its neck, killed it.
They're hard to hit, man.
Makes the dream work.
Steve's ready to talk about tamales.
I like that gray fox.
Oh, that was cool.
That was a cool gray fox. I like asking the boys up down here about running to jaguars, which happens.
Yes. Yes, it does happen.
Jay said we would have probably seen a mountain lion. That didn't end up happening.
Didn't see a mountain lion. I didn't even cut a track.
Yeah.
Saw one maybe kind of mushed track of a lion.
I get the impression these guys run these cats. Like if they hear of a cat, one of these vaqueros sees a track or something, whoever they know with dogs is going to run that thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They got a stuffed one here. I don't know if you'd call that even a stuffed one, but a very like basic attempt at taxidermy of a lion outside there. Yeah, tamales. So today we made venison tamales yesterday and today with guidance from Carolina.
Yes.
We took four shoulders.
Four and a chunk of neck.
And keep in mind, a coos deer buck only weighs, he's like, you know, 100 pounds. And these things are lean.
Unreal
lean. Lean gene right now, man. They look like greyhounds because they've been rutting for a while. I think we're kind of toward the tail end of the. They got no fat on them.
Imagine taking a rolling pin and smashing out a chunk of Wrigley spearmint gum and laying it out, smoothing it out flat. That piece of gum that is now flat.
After it's been chewed a little bit.
Is
not one right out of the wrapper.
No, I'm saying right out of the wrapper and just smash that thing out. That's how much fat my buck had on it. I was amazed.
You know the fat they get around, like inside their pelvis, like the kidney fat and stuff.
Yeah,
a couple little mini globs of fat there. You know, in the lower digestive, like outside of the lower digestive tract, you'll find like some fat. He had some fat there.
Yeah,
some fat around his kidneys. No body fat. The one we skinned out. Well, you skinned it with me.
Yeah. In between the anus and like the end of the tenderloin.
Yep.
Right there.
Like, he has some fat in there.
Yeah.
But nothing on the top of his
not haunches. A lick. And when they're laying there, they look like it looks like a greyhound laying there.
Yeah. Just amazed.
Just, man, they work hard. And they don't eat. The bucks don't eat when they're rutting. I was worried that the meat wasn't going to taste that good.
I thought for sure it'd be tougher than hell.
Like it'd be poor condition or something.
Yeah.
But, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to add, I believe I'm right on this number, that white-tailed deer up in my neck of the woods, the number that I heard is that a buck during the rut up there can lose up to 30% of their body weight.
No shit.
Whoa.
Yeah, from how 30%. Much they run now. Somewhere in there, give or take.
That's amazing.
That's like me hunting doll sheep.
Oh, how much you lost.
So we took four full front quarters, so four front legs, boned out neck meat. What else we throw in there? Oh, we cooked some tongue the night before.
Yeah.
Real crispy little tongue, little crispers. What would you call those?
I think just cilantro, white onion, and a bunch of lime in there.
Yeah, like tongue cracklings.
Yeah.
That was a different meal. But we took four deer quarters, neck meat, and then Carolina boiled it in a pot for 6 hours until the bones come out of the pot just clean.
And yeah, we should put a couple heads of garlic
in the water. And we picked all that meat. Didn't take long at all. Picked all that meat, picked out, because there's no fat to pick out, barely to speak of. Picked out the sinew. It wound up with two big, imagine like a big-ass salad bowl. Household big-ass salad bowl. Two of those full of picked meat. And then so we had all that picked. And then we took the corn. It's like boiled corn.
Yeah, so it's bloated.
Bloated.
Like it's Yeah. Yeah, it's soaked up a bunch of water.
It's what they call hominy, right?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, except for this isn't
No,
split.
Hominy is a part of the kernel.
Hmm.
The hominy is a part of a kernel.
That's right. And but so this isn't like a ruptured, this hasn't been soaking in water long enough to where the kernel is split. It's just the whole, just a more, imagine like a bloated corn kernel.
Ran it through a grinder. Looks like a meat grinder. Like at a passing glance, you think you're looking at a meat grinder, but it's these two plates that mash together, and the auger runs the corn out, and you just mash, and it winds up being like a wet cornmeal.
Yes.
Then you take all that meat juice that you use for boiling down the meat and wet that even more, put in a ton of lard.
Healthy dose of lard.
Put in salt. Put in way more chili powder than you'd ever think you'd put in there. And blend that batter all up.
And baking soda.
Oh, we forgot a part. Then you take your buck meat. And you got your picked meat. You take a pot and you melt all your lard in the pot and put garlic and onion in that pot and cook it. And then discard the onion, which I thought was interesting.
Yes.
Then put all the meat in, put in buck meat water, chili powder, lard, and make chili Colorado.
Again, a lot of chili powder.
Mm-hmm. So you got a pot that's got chili Colorado, and then you got a pot that's got your mashed up cornmeal. Then you take corn husks, soak those in warm water till they're pliable, and you lay out the corn husk, and you take a spoon and put a big healthy dollop of the batter, the cornmeal batter on there, and spread it all around. Then you take the chili Colorado and lay it in there like you're laying a hot dog on a bun, and you roll it up, fold it real special, and then you stack them into a pot and steam them. Man, those sons of bitches good.
Yeah, that was good.
How many did we make?
That was good.
Oh, a lot.
About 70, 70 75.
70 yeah. Tamales and had leftover meat. Or did we use all of our meat?
No, we had enough for chimichangas. Well,
that's right.
Deep
fried up some chimichangas.
And wow.
Did that use up all the meat?
Nope.
Really?
No, there's a lot.
Still more?
Yeah. Carolina's probably taking 5 to 10 pounds home.
Of the chili Colorado, yep. Or just the meat, the pit
just
meat.
Just the shredded meat, yeah.
That's what's always tough on the tamale is your ratio of the maize. Is it maize?
Maize.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Corn. Some folks call it corn.
Or masa to the meat, you know. Because you always feel like you're stung if you get nothing but the masa. So they don't use up as much carne as you think. But holy, yeah, I went round two this evening with several of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were good.
Yeah. When you cross the border back in the U.S., you take your meat home. You can take your meat home on the bone. You can take it home off the bone. What you can't, you got to clean. If you want to bring a skull back, you got to bring the skull back clean. You can't bring a skull across that's not clean. So you got to boil it and clean it. The meat can go across on the bone. We're going to bring our tamales across. No problem. The tricky part is you can't bring a hide. Not that you can't. Remember I was talking about all those ticks. If you want to travel back in the U.S. and bring a cape, like you want to get the deer mounted, you need to get it that every single tick on that cape is gone, and the customs people will check that thing. They find a tick, you're back across the border. Am I right?
That seems impossible.
Yeah.
But I think most of Jay's clients cross with their capes.
Just get in there and pick all them ticks.
Yeah, or
have them picked.
Yeah.
Give someone $20 to pick ticks.
You think a high percentage evacuate the cape once that animal's been dead for a while?
Sure, that happens a little bit.
Yeah, maybe if they haven't attached themselves yet, but I think most of the ones I saw are so bloated, they're not going anywhere. I think a trick is to freeze them for a little while, make them real cold, you know, and then maybe they come off easier or something.
Kill them,
but
yeah.
You got to go through there literally with a fine tooth comb and a pair of tweezers for a couple hours.
Man, I just bring the skull.
I've seen a pint jar full after one cape.
Someone filled a pint jar with ticks.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Ugh, that's yeah. cool.
Two cups of ticks.
Man, I would never, I mean, you know, nothing against anyone that does. Just personally, I would never mess with that. Just bring the skull home. Set it on a skull shelf.
So what else do we have to do, Yanni? Because we still have to do that tonight.
That's right.
As far as like being legal beagle, going across the border mm-hmm. with our...
There's just some paperwork we get to fill out that says what we're bringing across.
Oh, okay.
How much meat.
And one, there is a tag.
One skull. Right. Yeah, you put a tag on.
Okay.
The antlers.
Is that just a customs tag or is that like an actual like game agency tag?
Yeah, it comes from the Mexican government.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The tag. But then the U.S. guys will check it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And when they ask to inspect our meat, we'll have to pull out our tamales.
Yeah.
Be like, right there, boy.
Be like, I counted those sons of bitches.
Yeah, that should be about it. But I was going to say, yeah, that Carolina, man, that helped us make these tamales, that's something that Jay set up too. You know, and that's something that I think that anybody can get that comes down here and does a hunt with Jay is you can just request that he... gets you a cook. So for a very affordable price, we ate some like super good authentic Mexican food. Not every night, we brought a lot of our own food, but I think she cooked her own like recipes. What, three nights? What else do we have?
How many tortillas
chili,
do you think?
Chili con Colorado. God, dude,
the tortillas. We had Italian one night and I put a tortilla in it.
Yeah.
It's so
and I brought down some fish.
Yeah, the fish
was
good.
Fish shack, and she cooked that fish for us.
Chorizo last night.
Cooked chorizo and eggs.
She left that in there.
Yeah, she made hundreds of tortillas for us to eat.
Hundreds.
And she made a big pot of pozole.
Which was amazing.
Really good soup.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do we have? Chili Colorado the first night.
Chorizo.
The chorizo.
She made chorizo, which is really good.
Dinner and breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Papas fritas.
Oh, man, those are good.
Yes, which is the same on both sides of the border.
Yeah, but yeah, there's something different about frying them in water.
Yeah, I think that's how they used
over a fire. She fried them over a huge fire outside.
Whoa.
Okay.
There we go.
Fried potatoes.
Giannis is
genuine fire fried potatoes.
Mm-hmm. But that was great. Because it really lets us to focus on the hunting and the production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was noticeable.
Being up late. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I was like, why are we getting to bed so early? And it was because somebody was here getting food ready by the time we got back.
Yeah, really, and you'll be able to watch and see. We filmed it, and I presumably filmed it beautifully.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Looks
the way long, long kind of beautiful process of
making tamales.
Yeah, of tamale production.
It was a nice scene.
You could do it in a day, but it took it's something that it really should be done over 2 days.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we did it like an outdoor kitchen area over wood fire. A lot of it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It's dude.
I can't wait to put, I think it's going to be a really cool scene, man.
It's going to be a really cool scene. Carolina's awesome. Even though she didn't say much, she's kind of like a cool, like, grandma style guide passing on the knowledge of tamale making.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Good laborers. I think she appreciated it.
Yeah.
She gave you the unskilled.
At times I saw her laughing at us.
Yeah. There were a couple. Yeah.
I a long time ago had a bunch of muskox meat and gave muskox meat to a Guatemalan woman. And our deal that we struck was, I would get half my muskox meat back in tamales, which is a good deal.
Yeah.
Because you wind up getting a bigger pile of stuff back than you gave. Like I gave her like, I think I gave her like 20 pounds of muskox meat and I got 10 pounds, which is a ton of tamales, 10 pounds of meat. And I had wrapped them all up and put them in my freezer. And I just pulled those suckers out and eat them. They were good. Even frozen, even, you know, frozen, thawed, and warmed up were wonderful.
What's the best way to warm a tamale? Like reheat a tamale?
I feel like what I was doing, if I remember right, I feel like I was sticking them in my oven.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think I was microwaving them. I think I was throwing them in my oven. I wrapped them in foil.
Yeah, or just steam them again.
Re-steam them?
Yeah.
That's going to be
that's what I would do. That's
lunch
what I'll
meat eater office that's for what, a while.
I might even have to have another one before I go to bed.
I'll do it. I'll do it. Oh, yeah.
Nightcap tamale?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Rick, what's your, your closing thought, your conclusion?
Oh, all right.
You can go back. You can go back to luring in ladies.
No, this is
that drone.
Is that
how much fun we had on the mountain?
I mean, it's been a while since I've worked on one of these. One of the shows. I was busy this fall, so I sadly didn't get to go on any of the adventures. I missed out on a fog knack, happily. the first hunt I filmed was a coos deer hunt with Remy Warren.
That was your first foray into filming hunts?
Yep. It was, I'd never done it, and I thought, it sounds like it'd be a good experience, but I didn't realize that it would be such a something that I look forward to.
You don't regard it as lowly?
No, it's actually, I think it's kind of, in a lot of ways, it's like everything that I like about filmmaking distilled into a very pure form.
Because you come out of nature documentaries and whatnot.
Yeah.
Dudes frown on you? Does that community frown on you? Because you go out and do the savagery?
I don't really check in.
You don't care about their opinion on it?
No. I mean, I feel like I'm more a part of just a filmmaking or documentary community, and then I have a niche. But I do a lot of different things. But I feel that it's just a challenging thing to do, to document these hunts in a way that conveys the aesthetic, the narrative, everything you guys feel about the hunt. So there's just a lot of complicated factors, and you just have to hike and keep up. So, I enjoy. I mean, compared to a lot of the jobs I'm on, you know, if you're in hotels or you just feel pretty bad at the end of every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you feel bad. And at the end of these days, you might feel tired, but you feel like, you feel like super, more like you're on vacation than you're at work.
Dude, the other day we did, go ahead. Yanni. We did a hunt, successful hunt, came back, did 100 push-up, little lunch break.
The Hundo Club.
Everybody got to a hundo, and then we went back out for an evening hunt, hiking all around.
Oh, yeah.
You feel better at the end. I mean, we're going to bed at
coos
like 8
deer, p.m. Just the whole deal. I mean, coos deer are easily one of my favorite animals to watch, or at least it's my favorite hunt that I've filmed. I just really like the process, glassing. It's very, there's a lot of patience involved. I was happy to get to come back, and this is my third goose deer hunt, but I feel like I'm part of the hunt itself. So, it was great. I really liked visually, this part of Mexico is really beautiful and different than I thought.
Every morning and every evening you get just a killer sunset.
Yeah, great light, really. A lot of lots, and everything's spiny, really cool plant. I mean, everything's cool about it. Yeah. So.
Well, we're glad you had fun, Rick.
Yeah, I like coming along. Thanks. And I mean, Cal. I got to hang out with Cal most of the time, and he brought me coffee every day. So.
Always had a warm cup.
Oh man, he just treats me. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like it's the relationship between a cameraman and whoever they're filming. It's this interesting dynamic, but.
Mark, I need you to take notes.
Especially in a situation like this where I really am I'm non-hunter. I don't really know what I'm like. I'm not expert. I do my best, but having Cal being like, all right, we're going to do this. He's very patient, like explains the process, and he does it both on camera to the potential viewer, but also to me. So I think he, I just really enjoy kind of being able to hang out with somebody that is kind of guiding me through the process. And hopefully that translates to good TV too. And, you know, takes the viewer along for a ride. But I enjoyed wandering around with Cal out there. Actually, mostly we just sat, stared.
And you spotted some deer.
Very few. I felt bad. I tried hard, but I didn't have a tripod for my...
It was great. It was great.
It's hard.
Super fun.
Yeah.
Dude, I feel bad too every day for not spotting
enough deer.
They're there. Yeah, you know they're there.
That's... it's not... Yeah, they were there and I just not seeing them. But I did.
What I'm saying is you're not alone. Even after a dozen
deer hunts. You guys are so good at it though.
I still feel that way.
Yeah. But I did like when you guys couldn't amongst one another, because it happens to us because we just don't spend that much time behind binoculars, or maybe as much time, is when you couldn't find the animal that somebody else sees. It doesn't give me pleasure, but because I often feel that like somebody else sees something, I'm like, I don't know where you're looking. You get explained very clearly where it should be and you just can't see it.
What's happening there a lot of times is the one that sees it catches a movement.
Yeah.
Or catches it out in the open.
Right.
And so then they got a lock on it. And then it moves into a shitty spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And then other people, like the original finder, it gets in a spot where the original finder wouldn't be able to find it either if they didn't already know it was there. And then it gets really frustrating.
Yeah,
but that didn't happen to me.
No, but
you follow what I'm saying? Because then you wind up being like, well, okay, but he's kind of behind that bush. If you look, you'll see his foot sticking out.
No, and it is something about once you notice something, it becomes visually more obvious than. But
I like seeing that dynamic unfold because you guys are all very good at spotting things. And so when you get frustrated and not being able to...
But I think you're specifically talking about...
because I feel that way often.
The talking in.
Yeah, talking in. Whole process is just like...
I regard that as... This is going to sound bold.
Uh-huh.
But I think that... I regard that as one of my specialties.
Talking people.
I feel that I do a pretty good job of trying to talk people into where I'm looking. You know why? Because I take the time. I take the time. I think Cal does some big leaps. He doesn't walk you through every tree. I'm like, okay, and then there's that tree. And then if you immediately go, then there's that tree. And then if you go 6 o'clock from him, there's that bush. Cal's like, oh, and over.
One thing I would do more consistently is the your o'clock method.
Dude, the o'clock is the only way to play.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If you're not running center clock to describe, what we're talking about is you see something, you try and tell people where it is. So I go to like a feature that everyone would agree with. Start with, and it could be anywhere, to start with something that everyone could agree on, like that big, huge, rocky peak. And people are like, got it. And then work from there.
Okay. Yeah, it's a good method.
Go towards 7 o'clock from there until
you have an unfair advantage because you're such a, you know, a natural teacher and a patient individual.
That does help. It does help.
No frustration.
Mark, what do you got? If you had to take the whole, like one thing from the whole thing, what would that one thing be?
That has to be my concluder?
Yeah, it's kind of like the spirit of concluders. Or you can come out of left field. I don't know. You can talk about Rick, whatever.
Well, my one thing is kind of a two-parter, I guess. Because the one thing that struck me the most about this, what was so cool, was the taking of something that's so familiar to me and that I'm so passionate about, white-tailed deer, so known to me, and then throwing that into a situation in a landscape so unknown to me. So seeing this my favorite game animal, without a doubt, white-tailed deer, here in a place that's so foreign and new was a lot of fun. Everything was new about this, not just the place, but also, as we talked about, you know, this type of hunt. So that was really, really fun, really interesting. But what it did leave me with was a desire to go back to a little bit of the familiar, which was I wanted to be closer to these animals. Like, one of the things I love about hunting whitetails back home is being 20, 30 yards from them and hearing them and being afraid to move or make the slightest sound or different things like that. So coming out of this, I think the biggest thing I'm taking away is how awesome it was and how I want to try to bow hunt one of these suckers someday.
People do it.
Yeah.
It'd just be like an entirely different approach.
Yeah. It'd be so different, difficult, but like this kind of leaves me charged with wanting to try that someday because it would just be neat to try to figure out some way to slip in really close to one of these.
I think
guys.
You'd want to get into a situation where you had a buck, you had like a some of that rutting activity where you got a doe and there's bucks chasing around. Just get down in that zone and see what happens.
Yeah. I think it's certainly possible.
Play the wind, get in that zone, and then just kind of try, just wait and see what opportunities or if he moves.
Yeah.
You'd spend a lot of time having no idea where they were because you're on their slope with them.
Yeah.
And you might hear something, but it'd be tricky. But I mean, I don't, you know, people do it.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, the other day after I shot my buck, you came up and we had seen this other deer, and then all of a sudden we heard a deer grunting. And he came right by us. I mean, he must have been within 40, 50 yards probably. But you could never see him. He was downslope enough and the brush was tall enough and he was small enough probably that right there, probably within bow range, no idea though where he was.
Yeah, I had a buck at 10 yards. We had to be jumping over a road going, bat. He had a dainty little bat.
The little bat. Little guy grunt. Yeah, but so cool, and I just really appreciate you guys having me along. I mean, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity probably for me or a lot of people, and man, I enjoyed it.
That's good to have you, man. Glad you got something out of it.
Yeah.
Callahan? Cowhan, as my kids call him.
Callahan? Hey, Callahan. Yeah, just phenomenal trip. I guess observations, just the scale. Like, the grass isn't abnormally tall. The deer are just short. Like, it's knee-high grass. And I definitely had a hard time, like, making my brain put these deer at the proper scale over and over again. And they're gorgeous critters. Really, really had a good time. Really enjoyed the terrain. Real ankle breaking hills out here though, like all that loose rock, round rolling loose rock. Got to see a coati, which was pretty hilarious, and that was a good Rick Smith. We were hiking up the road, and he's like, "Oh, you know, I think this poop here is from a coati."
Cody.
Well, so there's a couple of
different ways to pronounce it. I don't want to hash it out. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, it's like a
souped up raccoon monkey.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. And I was like, oh, yeah. You know, I saw one of those down on the Yucatan on the side of the road one time.
Yeah. You see them out. They come out at night digging, like looking around the beach for shellfish and crazy stuff. Yeah.
Really cool. And, you know, later on that day, we're sitting on this ridge. Getting outsmarted by these coos deer bucks, and I stand up and look, and Rick was, you know, always attentive like Rick always was, so he was locked in his binoculars down on the ground, and I was like, oh my god, like, Rick, you're, and I couldn't remember the name, so I'm like, you know, Mexican bush monkey. Rick, get up. So that was super fun. It's just a great trip, man. All of it. Just odd observations at this point. I'm getting kind of tired. But the meat was fantastic. The people were fantastic. I love the pace of life and Beto and Carolina down here were huge parts of the trip. And
Carolina.
Yeah, stellar crew, you know. One thing that I always love about running around the woods with photographer types is the fact they like to notice, and it's their job to notice also, like all the all the good extra stuff. You know, it's not just the deer. It's the sunrises, the sunsets, the big thorns, the bonus critters. That's really enjoyable.
Ridge Pounder.
Viva Mexico, bro.
That's all you got to say. You loving it?
Loving it. Sunsets. It? I mean,
that's fine, man. You liked filming that sunset.
Oh, dude, sunsets down here were
big throbbing droner.
Dude, spiritual awakenings in those things, man. They're crazy. It's cool. It's really cool down here.
Johnny's. I think that's what they called you at the border. Johnny's?
Something like that. No, actually, I think that the guy at the Aduana, we got our tourist visa. I think he actually pronounced it properly.
No, man, I was standing there waiting for him to pronounce it because I was excited about what would happen. And he said, Johnny's.
Yeah, anyway. I thought he did a better job than normal. I love coos deer. What I like about it when I always leave, I like the fact that I still feel like a real beginner at this thing and hunting them. And it's great to have a quarry out there that I'm unfamiliar with, and that every time I come down for a hunt, I feel really like the odds are against me. We see a lot of little bucks, and I think if you just didn't care, you know, what kind of buck you're going to shoot, then I wouldn't feel that way, because you probably could get that done in a couple of days. But if you set out to shoot something that's, you know, whatever, a little bit bigger than average, older than average, however you want to put it, it's a real challenge, and it's not easy to do. And I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. I like being just a beginner.
It is the kind of thing where you think like, oh man, next year I'm gonna, because it's just, you never feel like you got it totally figured out.
Yeah, I think we stayed down here for two more weeks and guided, you know, four guys a piece. That would add up pretty quick. Yeah. But yeah, a week at a time here and there, and
yeah, I'm with you though, dude.
They're man, tough.
Great, it's instantly addicting.
My favorite part of the trip was honestly watching the tamales get made.
That was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's like, you know, you encounter people in life that you're just not, that you know, you don't really know what their trip is, right? And they don't understand, like, you don't really understand the details of their life, and you don't understand the details of their life, and you're probably not even equipped to understand the details of one another's lives. And then the language barrier makes it even that you're especially not going to understand the details of each other's lives. But there's like an empathy there, like a human empathy or desire to connect. And it's just cool to be able to spend a bunch of time with someone and like learn some food preparation like that. And it winds up being that you just get the sense that like people are enjoying themselves and feeling not entirely different. You know, and that's the kind of thing, like, you know, to be in a situation where it's a strange relationship to have with someone, to be like someone that you don't know, and you're down filming, and so you hire someone to do some cooking for you, and you can't talk really that well. It's just an unusual relationship, right? It's like it's a relationship that tends to make me like that kind of relationship makes me uncomfortable, because I feel like there's somehow like an unequal footing in some way. But then to be able to hang out today doing that and watch someone do something and do it well and do it very beautifully, I thought was cool. It was a nice, I mean, I loved the hunting, you know, the hunting's great. And I'll come back many times to do it. We're already talking about coming back next year, but like those little connection points, I think are pretty cool.
Would have been a completely different trip without that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just would have been.
And kind of her relationship to, you know, attitude about deer meat. It's a coveted thing.
Yeah.
You know.
It was awesome.
Yeah, it was fun to watch, man. And then just like the measuring cups.
Yeah.
just everything by just the eyeball, just like having done it and done it and done it and done it and done it. And then a pair of hands that have seen a tremendous amount of work.
Not specialized work. Work.
Yeah.
Like work, work. Yeah.
Hands like that don't just happen.
No.
No, I like looking at all the guy, everybody's hands. They're all work, like a lot of time.
Yeah. It's good, man. It sets your head right. Some trips kind of set your head right, you know? It's fun. All right. Thanks for listening.